Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why, oh why, does everything in this economy turn out to be our fault? Yet another indicator today that consumers have to step up, because nobody else will. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 30th of July. Glad you could be with us. Coke, McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, and, I don't know, Apple, just for good measure. I'll give you a dollar if you can guess what they've got in common. No? All right, here's a hint. It's about corporate profits, revenue, more specifically. All four of them missed revenue expectations this past quarter, which is, in that twisted way that business news goes, your fault, and which might well be part of a much bigger economic problem. From New York, Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Starbucks blames you for its troubles. Not you personally, but the consumer. Its CEO says the slowdown in cafe traffic is partly because of weak consumer confidence. That number has dipped recently, and consumer spending stayed roughly flat. Economist Chris Christopher of IHS Global Insight says this environment is especially hard for companies occupying the middle market. Take restaurants.
Places that are not doing particularly well are some mid-tier restaurants because people don't want to pay that extra buck.
Cheap fast food places are largely doing well, and fancy joints with $40 entrees are also okay. He's talking about one of those bar and grill chains where they serve vaguely Southwestern fare and give you a pager to tell when your table's ready. The wait's not as long lately. Here's a Chili's ad fighting the trend.
The $20 dinner for two, now part of our menu all day, every day.
Chili's is moving the price down into the low end to let you know you can afford cheese fries and a quesadilla explosion salad. And yes, that's an actual menu item. If it sells, more tips line the server's pockets and they'll spend a few dollars more somewhere. Maybe the money goes to the company you work for, fattening your wallet. That's the hope, but forecaster Jim O'Sullivan of High Frequency Economics doesn't see consumer spending or confidence rising soon.
Unfortunately, there's probably not going to be a lot of change in the numbers over the next 4 or 5 months.
Until consumers feel better about the economy, more companies will struggle, possibly even the one that signs your paycheck. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There was news today about for-profit colleges, the Kaplan Universities of the world, the DeVry Institutes, as well as trade programs in cosmetology or medical billing or car repair or what have you. In all, about 10% of the total college student population in this country goes to for-profits. And a Senate report out today says those schools are a bad deal for a lot of those students and for taxpayers as well. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill has that story.
Senator Tom Harkin is no fan of for-profit colleges, or how, he says, they do business.
Exorbitant tuition, aggressive recruiting practices, abysmal student outcomes.
And nope, he's not done there. Harkin says most of the revenues received by for-profit colleges came from federal student aid programs. And those colleges spent less than 20% of that revenue on actually educating their students.
We can't continue to pour more and more taxpayers' dollars into this bottomless pit, and students really aren't getting much out of it.
The Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities, as you might expect, disagrees with the bottomless pit characterization and a whole lot of the rest of the report. Steve Gunderson is the group's CEO.
It's a very, careful use or misuse would probably be the right term of comparing numbers and statistics in ways that just don't make sense.
But he says there are changes Harkin recommends that he supports. Among them, better tracking of student outcomes, but for all colleges. Peter Wahlstrom is an analyst at Morningstar.
It has been a very difficult and challenging environment, I think most companies would agree, in the for-profit education space.
There's more oversight of how they recruit and do business, and enrollment is falling. But Wahlstrom expects headlines like today's will push for-profit colleges to do more to convince people that enrolling is a smart decision. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, the markets were open. That's about all that happened, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Depending on the survey you're using, Atlanta ranks either 10th or 11th on lists of North America's most congested cities. The traffic, of course, makes nobody happy. Neither, though, does one proposed fix for it, a 1% regional sales tax to fund new transportation projects. There's a statewide referendum on that tax tomorrow. And much like politics makes for strange bedfellows, so too does tax policy. Jim Burris has that story from WABE in Atlanta.
Atlanta traffic stinks. I live just 8 miles from work, but it often takes an hour or more to get home. So let's start the car, start the stopwatch, and see how tonight's commute shapes up. So there's an acronym you're about to hear a lot, T-SPLOST. Like y'all and bless your heart, T-SPLOST is an expression that's inserted itself into our vernacular down here. It stands for Transportation Special Purpose Local Option Sales Tax. It's a 1% sales tax that over 10 years will generate more than $8 billion for regional transportation projects. It's safe to say everyone in Atlanta hates our traffic. It's just as safe to say that's where the agreement ends.
If we're successful on Tuesday, we will move the equivalent of 72,000 cars each day from our roads.
We have to do something to address the transportation and transit needs of our state.
It's not every day Atlanta's Democratic Mayor Kasim Reed and Republican Governor Nathan Deal agree. But they and a lot of other unlikely allies are campaigning for the T-SPLOST. They say it will ease congestion and create jobs. It might even make it easier to get to the ballgame, says Atlanta Braves Executive VP Mike Plant.
The number one reason year in and year out that people tell us they don't come to more games is because of the traffic.
That's the case for the transit tax. This is the case against.
Hello.
State Senator Vincent Fort, a Democrat, hates the measure. Sweat saturates his white Vote No on T-SPLOST t-shirt as he knocks on Joyce Ingram's front door.
This is going to a tax on your groceries and your medicine.
If the T-SPLOST passes, Atlanta's sales tax would jump from 8 to 9%. The extra penny would go toward transportation.
And so I hope you will vote against
it. I'm going to vote against it. I'm definitely going to vote against it.
Okay.
Believe that.
As we continue down the street, Fort smiles at the thought of taking on big business, powerful politicians, and well-funded interest groups, and possibly winning.
We've got about $800. They got $8 million, and we've beaten them.
The we he's referring to is an unlikely alliance, including pro-transit folks, an environmental group, even the Tea Party.
This coalition, this is unprecedented.
Debbie Dooley is one of 22 original founders of the Tea Party.
You know, when these coalition together of groups that are normally on opposite ends of the spectrum come together in solidarity on the same issue, that should send huge red flags that this project list is seriously flawed.
Oh, the project list. Back here in my car, I've gone 3 miles in 23 minutes. I'm stuck on the downtown connector, where Interstate 75 and 85 merge and run through the heart of the city. At times, 14 lanes of stopped traffic. A few years ago, the connector made the list for the top 10 most congested roadways in the nation. But it's not one of the 157 projects the new tax would fund. That's one reason State Senate Majority Leader Chip Rogers broke rank with fellow Republicans to oppose the tax.
But a more reasonable approach would be to have traffic engineers sit down and literally list the most congested traffic problems in Metro Atlanta.
Instead, a roundtable of local elected officials came up with the list. So if you're keeping track of who's cuddled up in this unlikely anti-T-SPLOST bed, we've got one of the state's top Republicans, a popular Democratic senator, and a founder of the Tea Party. Even the head of Georgia's Sierra Club is anti-T-SPLOST. If the T-SPLOST passes, there's a lot of money in it for MARTA. No, that's not the name of another strange bedfellow. It is the name of our mass transit system. Connie Sir rides MARTA a few days a week from her suburban home into downtown where she works. She admits it's a bit strange for someone who uses transit to oppose a project that expands the system. She says this whole issue is a bit strange.
I have aligned myself with people against the T-SPLOST that I would not normally have done. I can't say particularly why. We all have our different reasons. But I also run into enough people who are in favor of it. I think it'll be a very interesting fight.
Home. 49 minutes, 25 seconds. Not too bad, but I'm still a little frazzled.
Is a commute like that, 8 miles and 3/4 of an hour, enough to get the tax passed? Well, polls suggest maybe not, but it's up to the voters to decide tomorrow. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
You know all those stories you've heard the past couple of years about how the post office is broke, billions and billions of dollars in deficits? Well, it's about time to pay the piper. Unless Congress does something by Wednesday, the Postal Service is going to miss a $5.5 billion payment it owes the Treasury Department. So is the mail still going to show up on Thursday? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
Turns out neither rain nor snow nor now default will keep your mail from being delivered. The money due Wednesday is a regular payment the Postal Service makes to Treasury to cover the future health care expenses of retirees and their dependents. Jim Sauber is chief of staff of the National Association of Letter Carriers.
It's a kind of a scary word, default. It's not like a default that would be in the corporate sector on a bond.
So that package you ordered from Amazon will arrive on time. Still, Sauber says the pension payments, like the one due Wednesday, are hobbling the Postal Service, and it shouldn't have to stockpile so much money. A. Lee Fritzler is a former chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission. He says even without the payments, in a year or so, the Postal Service won't be able to cover its expenses. And that will affect consumers. Postal rates would go up, and advertisers might abandon their weekly circulars.
It would be up to catalog mailers to go more and more online, coupon mailers to go more and more online or use newspapers.
Yeah, so the Postal Service might deliver less junk mail. I know you're sorry to hear that. But here's the biggest long-term impact of the postal money crunch. If Congress decides not to close any post offices and still wants Saturday delivery, somebody's got to pay. John Callen is a mailing industry consultant.
The government is going to have to subsidize that without question.
And where do government subsidies come from? That's right, you, the taxpayer. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, you hungry?
The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization has estimated almost 20% of greenhouse gases are attributable to the raising of animals for food.
But first, let's do the numbers. Man, what is it about Mondays? 9 down ones in a row now. The Dow Industrials dipped a fraction of a fraction, less than 0.1%, 2 points, closed at 13,073. The NASDAQ off 0.4%, 12 points. Ended things at 29.45. The S&P 500 gave back less than 1% and less than a point, finished at 13.85. Financial shares got a hit today thanks in part to JPMorgan Chase. It erased 2% after shares were downgraded by Deutsche Bank. Goldman Sachs slipped 0.75%. Tech stocks were mixed. Apple advanced more than 1.5%. Facebook, though, continued its slide down another 2.33%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.49%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on interest rates and the economy. So how are you feeling about the economy? The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And if you never got through your copy of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, this is for you. A 24-hour marathon reading of the classic takes place in Mystic, Connecticut. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A high-stakes and a high-tech game of Did 2, D did not, got going today in federal court in San Jose. Apple is suing Samsung for $2.5 billion for, Apple says, stealing the designs for its iPad and iPhone. Samsung, in turn, says Apple stole its designs from somebody else to begin with. But as for the technology at the heart of this whole thing, Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains that might not really matter at all.
Paulette Taylor has been a jury consultant on patent lawsuits for about 20 years. She says, for jurors, when you're called to a patent case,
it's like being set down in the middle of a foreign land where you don't speak the language and you have no idea what the customs are.
And so she says, the lawyer becomes the jury's guide to this strange place. In the case of Apple versus Samsung, I'll quote from the Apple's pretrial brief here. The jury must decide whether Samsung violated, quote, Apple's D677 and D087 iPhone design patents and the D889 tablet design patent. Translation? Did Samsung copy the rectangular shape, rounded corners, and the button at the bottom of the iPhone? Robin Feldman is a professor at UC Hastings. She says neither Apple nor Samsung can rely on the jury to understand the intricacies of the technology. What the lawyers need is a gripping narrative.
I think if you see really fine trial lawyers, their skill is their ability to tell a story.
Jerry Ivey is a trial attorney at Finnegan in Washington, D.C. Ivey defended an elevator company accused of a faulty electrical system that made its elevators free fall. Instead of trying to explain the complicated electrical blueprints and circuitry to jurors, Ivey put an elevator repairman on the stand.
And I would say, what did you do when you were told the elevator had free fallen into the basement? He said, we hoisted it back up to the top floor. I got on top of it and rode it without the safety devices.
He won the case by making it all about the elevator repairman. And why would he risk his life by riding on top of the elevator if he thought it was faulty? Lawyers say jurors in the Apple Samsung case will be looking for a story to hook onto, and it may have very little to do with understanding the technology. Or should I say, understanding a motivation to combine techniques used in application management systems with browser applications on portable electronic devices. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
A lot of people who know a whole lot about China say that if you want to know what the next big flashpoint over there is going to be, you got to keep an eye on the environment. There were huge and violent protests this past weekend near Shanghai. More than 10,000 people trying to get a paper mill wastewater pipeline stopped. Stopped it was by local officials there, but environmentalism in the world's second biggest economy still does have a ways to go, as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports now from Shanghai.
Years ago, as China stood on the precipice of an era of unbridled economic growth, its leadership made a deal with the people. You don't challenge our authority, we give you a better quality of life. For the Chinese, better quality of life used to mean the freedom to make money. Not anymore, says UC Irvine China historian Jeffrey Wasserstrom.
They're not willing to accept the idea that being able to buy more stuff at the store means your quality of life is improving if you're worried about the pollution levels in the water that you drink, if you're worried about the quality of the air you breathe, if you're worried about whether your children will grow up in a place with a decent environment.
This weekend's protests followed similar ones last month when thousands in southwestern China staged violent riots to protest a planned metals plant. The result was the same. The people prevailed, and the local government scrapped the plans for the factory. Despite these victories, Ma Tianjie of Greenpeace in Beijing says the Chinese government is responding too slowly to the public.
You cannot wait until the people got onto the street to make a decision or change a decision. I think participation should happen way before that point.
As it stands, the environmental assessment for a new factory in China doesn't allow for public participation at any stage. But this soon may change, says Ma. There's been a push by academics in China to involve the public at a much earlier stage in the development of an industrial project so that the violence China saw over the weekend will be prevented. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
All right, let's start this next story with a couple of stipulations, okay? One, that local governments, a lot of them anyway, and especially those in expensive parts of the country, want to create affordable housing. Stipulation number two is that those governments don't have a lot of money to create that affordable housing. So some of them are getting creative. they're encouraging homeowners to put their basements or their garages or their spare bedrooms to good use. They're called accessory apartments, and they are not, as it turns out, universally popular. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story now from Washington.
When Greg Sanders got out of grad school a few years back, he figured he'd move into an apartment. But he ended up finding a more appealing alternative, the basement of a single-family home on a leafy suburban street in Montgomery County, Maryland.
The space was bigger, it was closer and more convenient to a lot of things. The cost was pretty low.
The landlords were the homeowners, a middle-aged couple with two kids.
We used the same laundry machines. They dropped the mail off. It was a bit more friendly and intimate than your average straight apartment relationship, and that was fun.
Sanders has since married and moved out of the basement, but he's still the poster boy for a new push by planners in this Washington suburb for something called accessory apartments. Instead of putting up new buildings, they want to turn unused space in existing homes into affordable housing. Accessory apartments require a separate kitchen, bath, and entrance. And they help not only renters looking for a cheaper deal, they bring in extra cash for homeowners with fixed or low incomes. Dick Pavlin is a volunteer with Action in Montgomery, a church group that promotes affordable housing.
This could be an important way of helping some of those people remain above water on their mortgage.
National studies have shown accessory apartments do result in affordable rents without subsidies or rent control. But the county's plan doesn't fit the neighborhood vision of many civic organizations here.
Montgomery County, if you drive around, is a series of beautiful single-family neighborhoods all across the county.
Meredith Wellington is a former member of the county planning board, and she doesn't think the current board has thought through its push for in-home apartments.
There's no assessment in the proposal as to how schools could be affected, garbage pickup, police and fire protection, parking. Parking is a big issue.
But current county planners say these concerns are overblown. They've proposed limits, one accessory apartment per lot, a maximum of three occupants. An extra parking space has to be provided. Greg Russ is the zoning coordinator for the county planning board.
We don't believe that we're setting up a situation where the impacts are that great. So we believe the numbers we put in place, the conditions, the standards, will mitigate those situations.
Population pressures are forcing Montgomery County to urbanize quickly. But many neighborhood activists think county planners are sending newcomers to the wrong place. Lydia Sullivan is a founding member of a new community group fighting in-home apartments called We Are MoCo.
If the county wants to get serious about affordable housing, they need to put more of a burden on those who can afford it the most, the commercial developers, and not place this burden on the backs of neighborhoods, schools, traffic, and power infrastructure.
She thinks home builders are backing the extra apartments in residential neighborhoods to get out from under affordable housing requirements on new developments. The county council takes up the proposal this fall. As for Greg Sanders, the 32-year-old who rented an accessory apartment out of grad school, he's thinking the arrangement just might work for him in old age.
I'll probably someday have some extra rooms that won't actually be that useful for me. And I'd much rather be able to keep the house and have a tenant to, you know, check in on me on occasion.
But he's not ready to take on the duties of landlord just yet, even though the townhouse he owns with his wife has enough space for an extra tenant. In Montgomery County, Maryland, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Sometimes when you got a really complicated thing you have to solve, it's easiest to break it down into a whole bunch of more simple things. Commentator Mark Bittman says a fix for climate change might start in the kitchen.
Everyone talks about the well-documented effects industrial meat production has on energy, water usage, and public health. We hear plenty about what treating animals like widgets does to our souls. But one thing that's underplayed is the effect of industrial meat on climate change. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization has estimated almost 20% of greenhouse gases are attributable to the raising of animals for food. Some researchers claim the real number is more like 50%. But the exact percentage doesn't matter. What does is that we don't take the role of livestock and climate change seriously enough. Most proposed solutions focus on developing new forms of energy, even though they can't be brought online fast enough to avert what may be a coming catastrophe. Adjusting our eating habits is a much easier fix. Although Americans are eating somewhat less meat, it still amounts to something like 200 pounds a person every year. If you believe that Earth's natural resources are limitless, or that technology will one day fix climate change, I guess none of this worries you. But if you believe in dealing with reality and want the planet to be a livable place for your kids, this is a big deal. It's seldom that enormous problems have such simple solutions, but this is one that does. Yes, we want cleaner forms of energy and transportation, but don't look for those anytime soon. In the meantime, we can begin eating less meat. That's something each of us can do with no technological advances. You've already changed your light bulbs. Now, how about eating a salad?
Mark Bittman is the author of, among other books, How to Cook Everything. You can share your thoughts with us on our website, on Twitter, at MarketplaceAPM, or on Facebook, whatever works for you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, just because I'm a bit of a space geek. Later this week, NASA is going to make its latest and much ballyhooed attempt to land a rover on Mars. Go look up 7 Minutes of Terror on YouTube to see how dicey it's going to be. But this item caught my eye today. A new series of pictures of the moon that show 5 of the 6 American flags put up by the Apollo astronauts 40 years ago are still standing. The one that's fallen down? The first one, Apollo 11. All right, that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow off less than a 10%, about 2 points or so. The NASDAQ off 0.4%, 12 points. The S&P 500 gave back less than a 0.1%. That is, obviously, less than a point. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Liza Madry. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.